So I chose four articles for discussion. I regretted three of them, but it's just how it is. This first one on external germ cell tumors is from our group. Tao Wang's a co-author. And I just focused on the subset from the mediastinum, which was the largest group of extragonadal germ cell tumors, as you might imagine. You know they're rare, and you know that the mediastinum is frequently affected. And so I thought it appropriate for this discussion. And what the authors wanted to do was evaluate the clinical morphologic and immunohistochemical features and analyze the chromosomal abnormalities, focusing on isochrome 12P. So it's a retrospective review of cases, both in-house and consultation cases, diagnosed between 2001 and 2020 here at Michigan. They had a total of 77 patients. 29 were from the mediastinum, and as I've already said, that was really what I wanted to share with the group. They looked at clinical records for the usual demographic features, tumor characteristics, et cetera. I don't know what that looked like for consultation cases. They talked about the histological and immunohistochemical features where there wasn't really any new information, affirming that immunostains in extragonadal germ cell tumors behave the same way they do in gonadal germ cell tumors. And they did whole genome SNP array analysis on a subset of cases, which turned out to be 8 of the 29 mediastinal germ cell tumors. They were looking at specifically for isochrome 12P, as I said, but also looking at other copy number alterations. And for that, they used the OncoScan FFPA assay kit. So that's what they did. So what did they learn? They were mediastinal germ cell tumors were more common in males than females, with median and mean ages of 26 and 28.7, but a pretty wide age range as reflected in a large standard deviation. Three of the five prepubertal patients were females. So the kind of male to female ratio applies to adult tumors, not those in childhood. They varied widely in size from 2.5 centimeters to 21.5, with median and mean of 9.8 and 10.3. In terms of the germ cell tumor components, I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody, certainly not Anya. In terms of pure tumors, they were about as equal as mixed tumors, and the most common pure tumor was mature teratoma. Have to be careful, of course, because the most common combination of findings was teratoma and yolk sac tumor. Seminoma was another pure tumor type, as was yolk sac tumor, and then various combinations, as you can see in the pie chart. As I mentioned, the immunohistochemistry results didn't have any surprises. It's table two in the paper if you want to look at it. But the key messages here, as they are for gonadal tumors, is that OCT4 is useful for separating seminoma and embryonal carcinoma from yolk sac tumor, yolk sac tumor being negative. CD30 positive staining was limited to embryonal carcinoma. Glypican-3 and alpha fetoprotein limited to yolk sac tumor and CD117 to seminoma. The cytogenetics are outlined in their table three, but basically they showed that isochrome 12P is actually uncommon in extragonadal germ cell tumors in contrast to gonadal germ cell tumors. Interestingly, somatic malignancies only occurred in mediastinal extragonadal germ cell tumors. They didn't see it in any other tumor sites. It was seen in 6 of 29 mediastinal tumors, was adenocarcinoma in one and various flavors of sarcoma in the others. Only 4 patients were dead of disease, and that included a prenatal patient, patients 7, 14, and 15. So one of the takeaways is, this is bad news if you're a kid, but adult extragonadal germ cell tumors tend to be affiliated with a good prognosis, including one who was alive with no evidence of disease who had a somatic malignancy that was rhabdomyosarcoma. So that is not a uniformly fatal combination of findings. They had follow-up on 21 of the 29, which I thought was pretty good. So for me, the take-home messages were mediastinum, common site for rare extragonadal germ cell tumors that present in a pretty broad age range, Pure tumors are about as common as mixed tumors. Young age and somatic malignancies are affiliated with a more aggressive course. Anya, any reflections? Anything you want to add?
No, I was just wondering, you do have quite a few Yorg sac tumors. Did any of those, did they describe any angiosarcomas in them or these vasculogenic mesenchymal tumors that they recently brought up?
I don't recall. Do you recall, Tao?
I don't.
I'll have to look that up on you.
Yeah, no, I don't see it described in here either. Would have been just, interesting
Yeah.
if other people find these things too.
Yeah.
And then they always say that the germ cell tumors in the mediastinum have a worse prognosis than the ones in the gonads.
Yeah, this data set doesn't reflect that. I think one of the things that surprised me was the relatively good prognosis with these tumors.
I wonder if they also over the years changed actually their approach to these tumors because they used not to resect any of those. But I have
Yeah.
the feeling now some either get resected by mistake because they think it's a zymoma and then all of a sudden it's a seminoma, or they resect them post chemotherapy. So
Yeah.
maybe that also leads to a difference in prognosis.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. I just had one, an in-house case that was
You
post
did?
chemotherapy, yep, teratoma that they resected. So they are resecting them.
Cool.
Thanks for picking that article. I
I
really
just
appreciate
I did it just for you, Anya.
it. Thank you.
Any other comments, or we can go on to the next one? I chose the next one mostly because this came up multiple times at the Pulmonary Path Society in New York. Questions about HER2 in non-small cell lung carcinomas. Lynette Scholl was asked how they do it, and do you use the breast or the GI? Everyone was agreed that you use the GI model, but actually this paper kind of speaks to that. So I thought it would be interesting. I actually thought it would be more interesting than it was, but that might just be me. So this is a paper from Modern Path. Oddly enough, three of the four papers are from Modern Path. That's partly because Tao Wong stole all my papers from the American Journal of Surgery
I'm sorry for that.
Path, for which I was grateful. So as we heard in New York, and as you no doubt know, HER2 alterations, including mutations and amplifications, have been identified in a lot of cancers, including non-small cell lung cancers. And there was a recent trial investigating an antibody drug conjugate, trastuzumab and deruxtecan, that demonstrated a 55% response rate in 91 patients with metastatic HER2-mutated non-small cell lung carcinoma. And 84% of those also were positive in terms of protein expression, the usual IHC assays. And I think that was fueling the conversation in New York and Lynette Scholl's comments. So the current study wanted to elucidate any clinical, pathologic, and molecular characteristics unique to HER2-altered non-small cell lung cancers, and then really talk about approaches for identifying patients likely to benefit from targeted therapy. And their analysis went beyond just the breast versus GI criteria. So it's a retrospective cohort study. So they looked at 1,680 non-small cell lung carcinomas that had next generation sequencing plus or minus CISH, and they identified 105 HER2 amplified or mutated tumors. Now, that doesn't mean their study group was 105, it got smaller. Not for entirely clear reasons. 12 were excluded because either they had inadequate immunohistochemistry or they were amplified as a result as a mechanism of acquired TKI resistance. So they wanted to kind of look at pretreatment alterations of HER2. For their control group, they had 165 non-small cell lung cancers that had NGS that were not HER2 amplified or mutated. And that included 97 consecutive surgically resected adenocarcinomas, 68 of which had HER2 immunohistochemistry. For their NGS, they used either the TruSight Oncology 500 panel from Illumina or the Cancer Scan from Geninus, I guess is how you pronounce that. Clinical pathologic data and tissue slides reviewed, including the immunohistochemistry and the silver in situ hybridization. And they scored according to the ASCO CAP guidelines for both breast and GI to kind of get a sense for which one works better in this context. And ultimately, their study set was 89 patients with HER2-altered non-small cell lung carcinoma that they compared to their 165 controls. So that HER2 alterations in 89 represents 5.3% of their original cohort, about a little under 2% amplified and a little over 3% mutated, and some had both. And that's consistent with previous reports in the literature. So the prevalence of HER2 alterations made sense. Nearly 97% of their patients in both the study group and the control group presented with stage 3 or 4 disease, which kind of speaks to the nature of lung cancer. In terms of stage distribution, there was no difference between their study group, the HER2 altered tumors, and their controls. The majority of their mutations, over 80%, were exon 20 insertions. In total, 52 of their mutations were in the tyrosine kinase domain. 7 were non-tyrosine kinase domain mutations, and those were more commonly point mutation. The point mutations were more common in the non-tyrosine kinase domain mutated tumors. Those that were had tyrosine kinase domain mutations tended to be younger, tended to be female, tended to be never smokers, tended to have adenocarcinoma histology, so they looked like patients with other tyrosine kinase domain mutations. That was not true for those that had mutations in the non-tyrosine kinase domain exons. So 61% of the HER2 mutated cases showed incomplete or complete membranous HER2 immunoreactivity, meaning that over a third didn't. Some amplified cases had high copy numbers but low IHC scores. So they made the observation that immunohistochemistry was not a reliable predictor of HER2 mutated tumors. Frequent co-alterations included TP53 mutations in two-thirds, and those were more common in those with HER2 amplification and non-tyrosine kinase domain mutations than those with tyrosine kinase domain mutations. Other actionable mutations were really mutually exclusive from those with tyrosine kinase domain mutations. So some familiar themes with what we see with other actionable mutations. In terms of histology, micropapillary histology was frequently focal and more common in the HER2 mutated tumors. Not only the micropapillary histology, but also lung-to-lung mets were more common in those that had tyrosine kinase domain mutated tumors than in the control group, not compared to other HER2 altered tumors. So that was a distinction between them and the controls. There was poorer survival in patients with HER2 alterations compared to controls, and the shortest survivals were in those with non-tyrosine kinase domain mutations. Now, in terms of scoring immunohistochemistry, neither scoring system performed better than the other. So in terms of which one you use, there are conventions, but there's no evidence that one is better than another. And in fact, if you look at the distribution of scores of 0, 1, 2, and 3, they were the same. The problem in both was 2+ scores, where 14 and 9 were HER2 mutated, depending on whether you use the gastric or breast system, and actually also some of the controls. But if you considered only 3+ as overexpression, that actually had the highest accuracy and specificity, but lower sensitivity. And discordant IHC scores were more common in HER2 amplified tumors with concomitant mutations. So I think the take homes were that HER2 alterations are present in small but significant number of non-small cell lung carcinomas. They are associated with distinct clinical pathologic characteristics and a poorer prognosis than non-HER2 altered tumors. And actually, they propose that really the right test for identifying these patients is NGS, not immunohistochemistry, given the heterogeneous expression patterns. And they argue that understanding the molecular landscape of HER2-altered tumors may lead to better targeted therapies and improved outcomes, but that really is a hypothesis. It's not something you can conclude from their results. So I thought that was interesting in the context of the discussions in New York. Any comments?
Well, thank you for presenting that. Maybe it's just me because I'm not involved in the breast HER2 or gastric HER2 sign out. So for me, that's all new. But looking at that figure, the figure two in that article, I mean, if I would have seen D, F, or J in isolation, not together with B, I would have called that 3+, I have to admit. But they call it 2+, which has a different meaning because I think then it should go to cytogenetics. So I guess I don't know if other people
Yes.
struggle with that too, or it's just me. What's the trick?
I didn't try to grade these, but it's a good point. Let me show the figure you're talking about, this one here, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
And on top of that, Anya, we actually in lung we don't reflect to cytogenetics or
Oh,
to
we don't,
HER2.
because I went by Ying Chun's outline from the
Yeah,
gastric, and
yeah,
apparently the gastric they do.
yeah.
So we don't, huh? Well,
I think
what
you're
do we
also
do
just.
with these results?
Well, I think I think that's an open question. I think the message to our oncology colleagues is if you really want to know the answer to this question, you probably need to do NGS. I don't know that that will change behaviors because they didn't. I'm not sure what they did in that clinical trial that showed the 55% response rate. They did immunohistochemistry, but they also did molecular. But they said that the IHC was informative and only 84%. And that's not usually a level of performance that any oncologist will be comfortable with, right?
I sat in that, well, the guy who presented from Yale at the Pulmonary Path Society, I don't remember his name, but he wasn't a lung pathologist, right? But he was an he ran their immuno lab, and he was
Yeah, that was David
deeply
Rim,
in,
wasn't it?
yeah, David Rim. And I leaned over to him and I said, "So what you just told us is it's all voodoo." And he said, "Yes, really it is."
Yeah.
To your point, Anya, I mean, I think you really need the NGS, and I think maybe that's the answer here.
May I add some comment?
Sure.
Yeah, I think those are two different things that the drugs can work. So the mutation part or the amplification part, the drug works. But the ADC now is that we know that's the current wave that those antibody drug conjugate, they recognize protein expression on the surface. So in those cases, they will have protein expression 3+ on surface. They may or may not have amplification or underlying mutation. It's just biological, they have overexpressed. Same as like TROP2, CEACAM5, those high for the ADC. So I personally think to compare them is important, but not necessarily use one method to replace the other one because those are different circles. They have some overlaps, have some others. They are positive in this one, but negative in that one. Kind of all of them responds to HER2 antibody drug conjugate to some degree. And that's how the trial has been on the 3+ for that. But it doesn't mean that IHC is a replacement or surrogate for mutation or amplification. I think that's what my take for HER2.
Yeah, that's super helpful.
And I think in the paper that last month I presented from Dr. Lina Shaw, she showed that amplification with TDK mutation actually destroys the expression IHC. You couldn't see it. So that combo, you have amplification and also TDK mutation, you don't see protein expression by IHC.
Yeah, they said that was also true here, but it wasn't universal. Yeah.
Yeah, in her data, the most of the one does not have HER2 expression or high expression by IHC. They almost always have that TDK mutation on top of amplification. And
So
also in
is
her
there a
paper
clear?
demonstrate.
Sorry, so is there a cohort of patients then that don't have IHC expression but do show amplification that then respond to treatment, in which case we should probably be doing both?
Yeah, this paper didn't have any treatment-related information.
And for the current FDA approval, there's two approval. One is the mutation, including point mutation and exon 20 insertion. And the other one is the current IHC 3+. So there's no FDA approval for her to amplification in lung.
Thank
Yeah,
you.
thank you for that. Well, can I move to the next paper, which is even more frustrating? So this one has lung cancer in the title, but it's really not a lung cancer patient a paper. But it's a paper about a technology that I was very interested in, because we're all at various stages in our journey to a digital world. Mayo Clinic's all in. We're starting that journey next month. But the difference from radiology is we still have the same legacy assets, right? Which is very different from radiology, where they don't have film anymore. And the question is, how long until that's different? And so I thought this paper would be helpful given the title, Lung Cancer Diagnosis on Virtual Histologically Stained Tissue Using Weekly Supervised Learning. Which sounds like our fellowship, really, I suppose.
Yeah.
So again, the title suggests it's about lung cancer, but it's really not. But what's really weird about this paper, it seems to me, is they spend a lot of time in the introduction talking about how horrible our current model is. They use kind of hyperbolic language. They claim that traditional H&E staining is labor-intensive and time-consuming. And that for pathologists, it means, and this is their words, exhaustive inspection of the histopathology slides by pathologists under a bright field microscope or a whole slide tissue scanner. So their real purpose in this paper, they say, is to give us a faster, a less burdensome solution for staining slides, which I don't think they have any evidence to say that's true at the end of it. There are really two parts to this paper. First, they want to show the proof of concept for creating virtually H&E stained whole slide images from unstained label-free sections. And two, see how those sections perform when it comes to diagnosing and classifying lung adenocarcinoma. And that was the weekly supervised deep learning model. Their primary focus was developing what they characterize as a rapid, cost-effective, interpretable alternative for traditional H&E-based diagnostics. So in the first step, proof of principle for creating virtual histological staining using a weekly supervised deep generative model, they used autofluorescent images of label-free tissue, meaning unstained, native state, except formalin-fixed and paraffin-embedded, were converted to virtual H&E stained images using something called a U-frame model. And I'll tell you, I understood very little of the materials and methods in terms of the deep learning. But there were no time studies or anything else relevant to their interest in showing that this is either rapid or cost-effective compared to traditional workflows. So I thought I would just map out their materials and methods because I think it speaks to the opportunity. So the truth is, to get to their label-free section requires the same formalin fixation, paraffin embedding, and microtomy that a usual H&E slide does. And then you transfer the tissue to a more expensive quartz slide, and you use a non-scalable image capture microscope to get the image that they then convert to an H&E. And they did that work by coarsely registering that same section after it had been H&E stained with the autofluorescence whole slide image, and use that U-frame model to teach it how to make it look like an H&E. So if you look at what you're saving in terms of the process, you're saving an H&E stain and cover slipping, which is now a highly automated task. So when I read this paper, I went down to our histology lab and I asked a couple of folks, how much time do you spend staining and cover slipping? And they said, well, none. It's all in that machine. So that's the magnitude of the opportunity. It ain't much. So their claimed future state is that you go straight from the image captured from the quart slide with the non-labeled tissue to the virtual H&E stained whole slide image, as opposed to an H&E slide that goes through a scanner, and there isn't much difference. So the first thing I would say about the methods is there's no information here that will help you know whether there is anything more rapid or cost-effective about their model. The second part, which has kind of been done before, only not with virtually stained slides, was an attention-based multiple instance learning model. I don't know what that means, that was trained on H&E stained whole slide images from the Cancer Genome Atlas and validated using these whole slide images from two different hospitals that were considered ground truth. And the data set consisted, that data set consisted of 785 whole slide images from the TCGA and 1,059 from the Clinical Proteomic Tumor Analysis Consortium. And with further validation on the 117 virtual versus H&E paired whole slide images separated into training and test sets. And they measured diagnostic performance using accuracy and area under the curve. And the bottom line is it achieved high diagnostic performance, whether it was virtually stained or actually stained. There really wasn't a statistically significant difference. So their proof was that the virtually stained slides performed as well as actually stained slides. So I think the take-home message was virtually stained slides are feasible, and their diagnostic performance is equivalent. In either case, AI-assisted diagnosis continues to make headway, which is exciting. But any claims of reduced turnaround time and more efficient workflows are neither well-documented nor believable. And by the end of it, I decided that just because a paper sounds interesting, it doesn't mean you should want to review it for a journal club. You should probably decide that after. Any comments?
So I'm wondering, there are also these virtually stained slides where you can use, you know, kind of other stains, not only H&E, but other stains. And I don't really understand any of that. But I was wondering if the advantage would be if you have a small biopsy, you don't lose tissue, because it's at least in my imagination, you stain the same slide with basically virtually with different things, like a multiplex on one slide. So I could imagine if that's really the truth, then this could be an advantage if you have a small biopsy. But I don't even know where people stand with that. We certainly don't have it. And
Yeah, that's really a great point. If you could do all of the stains you needed on one slice of tissue, that would be cool. This paper only looked at H&E, and I was curious because I heard a talk by a guy at UC Davis who's got a different methodology for staining tissue. But his model is more appealing in the sense that it doesn't go through the usual processing. He stains fresh tissue that hasn't been formalin fixed or embedded. And that starts to look a lot more like what they do in radiology. You know, he's in very early stages and there's nothing about his current contraption that looks scalable, but that could all change over time. But I agree with you, Anya. I think that technology is exciting. I just think it's wrongheaded to say the advantage is that it'll make us faster and more efficient. Maybe someday it will, but that's not the state of this technology.
Yeah, I agree.
Any other comments or questions?
Just that I wonder if they're trying to patent something.
Sorry?
I just wondered if they were trying to patent something.
I think that
some of the early language in the paper is a little much.
Yeah, I think there's something at the end of the paper I noticed that said there was a patent pending. So yeah, they're working on that. There you go. So actually, I chose the last article for kind of the same reason. I picked this one because I was very curious what sort of progress we're making on being able to process tissue differently for whole slide images. And I picked this one because I keep hoping that there'll be an alternative to having to look at those PD-L1 stains. And that's, other papers have been reviewed in this journal club around this, and they've shown some promise, but they never seem to get quite to ready for prime time. So I thought maybe this would be it. I think most people on this call do have to look at PD-L1 stains and know that it's subjective and can vary among pathologists, and looking at them isn't very fun, at least in my opinion. So the authors claim we need an objective, repeatable method that ensures consistent and accurate assessment, and I think everyone would agree. I don't know how many times we've reviewed this before, but I know that Bland reviewed this in April of 2022 and looked at a couple of papers that showed promise for AI-driven decision support tools. So in four iterative experiments, this study really, I think, continues to demonstrate the effectiveness of a deep learning-based AI model to assist pathologists in scoring PD-L1. So that was really their goal. They wanted to understand how this might assist in the work rather than replacing the work, which I think probably is within reach. So they did this work with TMAs for the most part, although they did have a fourth experiment that kind of validated this using whole slides. But for most of the work, they used TMAs prepared with 2-millimeter cores from 665 non-small cell lung cancers and 27 normals. And these were all from surgical specimens resected at Kyoto University Hospital in patients with no prior chemotherapy. And they used the 22C3 clone on the DACO platform, and all of them were scanned at 40X. So in their first experiment, they took 54 of their non-small cell lung cancers and one normal, which was really to develop and validate their model for PD-L1 immunohistochemistry. And they divided those into three sets and annotated as ground truth regions of non-tumor, positive tumor, and negative tumor, which were their target classes. And in experiment number two, they used 584 non-small cell lung carcinomas to look at inter-observer variability. And they did this by having three pathologists independently score PD-L1 expression three times with at least a two-week washout between each of those reads. Like, I don't know how much they had to pay these three pathologists, but I hope it was a lot. So the ground truth that they used, which I think is very reasonable, was consensus across three category scorings for these 584 cases that they achieved mutually. So the three pathologists reviewed everything independently, and then they got together and agreed on using this three category scoring, which was less than or equal to or greater than 1%, less than 50%, and equal to or greater than 50%. So those were their three kind of scores. So in experiment number three, they looked at the utility of the model developed in experiment number one in predicting TPS using ground truth as the comparator. So their deep learning model determined TPS as a continuous variable and also so expressed as a percent, and then generated visual overlays that mapped PD-L1 positive and negative tumor cells and non-tumor cells. So there were kind of three outputs from their deep learning model, a percentage TPS and a map. And they then compared three models for TPS, a pathologist doing what they do today, working without any assistance, AI by itself, as a standalone, and then AI assisted scoring, which really used four different methods. One as a second read after the pathologist read it, and one a concurrent tool that you could look at while scoring. And the two versions of the tool that they got to use, so there were, that's the four methods, so secondary and concurrent reviews, and both of those done two different ways. In one, they got to see only the percentage, T TPS generated by the tool, and then the other, they got to see the percentage and the map, the visual overlay. And then experiment number four was to do the same thing using whole slides, not TMAs, from surgically resected tumors. And for this one, the AI-assisted model was just the concurrent read using just the percentage. So I take that to mean the pathologist thought that one, they liked that the best, which made sense to me. So what did they learn? So in terms of the validation of their model, how well could their deep learning model predict TPS? Those numbers are pretty high numbers, I'm told. I don't really understand the statistics, but I think they mean that the model functioned at a high level. When they looked at inter-observer variability, it showed moderate to substantial agreement with higher variability in a three-tiered assessment. When they looked at their assist cases, AI-TPS showed comparable accuracy to pathologist alone, so either model by themselves did okay. Although AI-assisted methods significantly improved accuracy for those cases in which there was discordance between readers. So it improved reproducibility. There were no significant differences found between the concurrent and the second reading assist modes. So, you know, I took that to mean that they chose the concurrent mode with just the percentage because their pathologist must have said it worked better or liked it better. When they assessed their surgical specimens, AI-assisted TPS also improved agreement rates in actual clinical specimens compared to the pathologists alone. So their conclusion was that using AI as an assist rather than a replace is perhaps the future. You know, and one thing I said in the take-home message, that's great for TPS cases, but I think if you ask most people who have to look at PD-L1 stains, they tell you the TPS are the easiest. And it's really the CPS that's, I think, struggles most with reproducibility. The DL-based AI model did not significantly differ from pathologist scoring in the overall cohort, but did improve with their discordant cases. So I think there's a vote to use it and probably to use it as an assist. So a little disappointed in that I don't think we're going to go out and buy anything tomorrow to make our lives easier, but I think in another 3 or 5 years, which doesn't really interest me, but it may interest you, there could be a better way to do this. Any questions or comments?
Hi, it's Margaret here. Matt Ficini said that he has a AI model set up to help sign out TPS and CPS at his hospital.
I'm not surprised. I think there are a number of people working on that.
Yeah. And he said it's very useful. It helps a lot. And he does it for CPS as well. So I'm trying to get our dinosaurs here to adopt it and try and help us out here as well.
Has he published that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
He will,
but
I
he
bet.
Said he's very happy to help and, you know, give us all the information we need. But the person who's in charge of this is like, well, no, not yet. I'm too busy right now, kind of thing. So I think he would be very happy to help.
Yeah, and speaking of Matt, so as I said in my email to you, the version of the discussion that I used for this morning is the one that I edited, starting with the ChatGPT generated summary. And my warning is it does a really good job of summarizing what the authors say, but it doesn't do any critical thinking. And I loved Matt's response email where he points out that really he's trying to create tools to assist, not replace, because the critical thinking is still our domain. So if you leave Journal Club to the last minute thinking ChatGPT will do it for you, I think you are mistaken. And if we quit to doing the critical thinking part, then it's not a Journal Club that's worth very much. It's just an article summary tool.
Exactly.
Well said, Jeff.
Any other comments? I don't have anything I particularly thought I should highlight from the from the notation articles, maybe a couple of things. I was interested to read, it's not particularly relevant to pathology, but we all see a lot of lung cancer. And I was kind of interested in the article on lung cancer diagnosis during pregnancy. And the reason I included it was to let you know that there's a registry and researchers who are interested. So if you see cases, you might want to keep that in mind. I thought the paper on SMARCA4 deficient thoracic tumors was kind of interesting. I edited that one quite a bit from the GPT comments. I think there are some shortcomings with the paper, but some affirming observations. I don't know that there are any new ones. The case report on endobronchial ultrasound guided cryobiopsy of pulmonary artery intimal sarcoma is one that you'll never need, I don't think, but it's really an opportunity for the Italian group to show you the extent to which they're capable of doing cool things. And I thought it was interesting to learn the Pseudomonas aeruginosa hides in the airway epithelium of cystic fibrotic patients, which kind of is a window into why they're at risk and the way they're at risk. All right. Well, thanks for attending.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yep. Bye.
Yay.
Bye.